Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 23rd. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll hear from Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Jeff, local students are responding to last week's shooting at a Florida high school. Students at a number of local schools are making plans to participate in a national walkout of their classrooms. This shooting has been such a powerful story in the news.
That's right. In the wake of that tragedy last week, Steve, we've seen a lot of high school students, particularly those at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School in Parkland, Florida, become involved in trying to influence their state legislators for tougher gun control laws. And a national movement is underway on the one-month anniversary of the tragedy, which would be March 14th, students across the nation are going to walk out of classes at 10 a.m. for 17 minutes. That's for the 17 victims of the shooting. And locally, we do have some groups of students who want to be involved in that. They are from Falmouth, Mashpee, Sandwich, Nantucket, and the Sturgis Charter School. So they're preparing to participate in this national day. Of course, the message is gun violence in our nation's schools has to end, and lawmakers need to pass legislation for stricter drug control laws.
And these demonstrations that we're talking about here on the local level, these really seem to be student-led.
They are student-led. And one of the groups here on the Cape, Engage Falmouth, that's very active in political movement here on the Cape, said, you know, we'll put out some Facebook messages, but we want to be very clear that the students are organizing this by themselves. And they are organizing it on their winter break. There's been no school this week.
That's right.
So they intend to meet with administrators once classes are back in session next week. But from what we understand, there seems to be support there. Here in Falmouth, the member of the school committee says he endorses their right to speak up. Member of the Falmouth Board of Selectmen, Megan English Braga, says all we ever hear about is apathy in young people. And if they want to engage in a respectful way, then we should support them.
And I saw even our state rep, Dylan Fernandez, chiming in there,
exactly.
The Vineyard Wind Project, which is an offshore wind energy proposal, heard from a range of supporters and critics just recently. These are comments on the environmental review by the state of this project. What kinds of things do they hear?
Yeah. This Vineyard Wind Project is probably the closest to becoming a reality here off the coast of the Cape. Hopefully construction will start in 2019. But it's under environmental review, especially for the project's underground cables that will be required. The proposal is to bring three underwater cables, electricity cables, from the site, which is 14 miles south of the vineyard, and to make landfall somewhere in Barnstable, probably Centerville or even West Yarmouth, and then it would run to a substation. So for this review, there are 150 people and agencies have sent in comments to the Department of Energy and Environmental Affairs. And of course, there are proponents and opponents. Mm-hmm. Senator Julian Sear, who represents most of the Cape and Islands, said approving this will demonstrate our commitment to clean energy future. The Association of Industry of Massachusetts and Boston chimed in saying this is great. There'll be job creation and reduction on reliance on natural gas and oil. On the flip side, and there are a lot of folks who submitted comments saying, you know, we need to look at the environmental consequences to Lewis Bay, where the landfall would be with these cables, and the potential effect on sea life and fish, as well as these fish and other sea life being affected by electromagnetic fields. And there's also the town of Barnstable, which has expressed concern about the project and hazards to the public drinking water supply should something go awry with these cables.
Mm-hmm. I also saw the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association weighing in. They have concerns about having these high-voltage cables running across the seafloor.
Right, right.
And the all of this, again, is about the environmental review that the state is doing on this project. And Matthew Beaton, the Secretary of Energy and Environment, Environmental Affairs, saying that really this is a review. He doesn't have even it's not within his job to stop it or let it go forward.
Exactly.
So it'd be interesting to see as the number of projects are proposed for that wind development area south of the vineyard.
I believe there's three of them.
Another story this week we have is about a methadone clinic that may be coming to Falmouth.
Yeah, exactly. A company based in South Carolina called Crossroads Treatment Center has conducted some research and determined Falmouth would be a good location for a methadone clinic. Methadone, for those who don't know, is used to treat opiate withdrawal. It's in the early stages of establishing the clinic, which would be located at what the office park called Bramblebush, which is adjacent to the Falmouth Hospital, and they'd like to open in the fall. Mm-hmm. This would be the second methadone clinic on the Cape. There is one in Yarmouth right now. And to move forward, they would need a building permit and approval from federal and state health officials. But where they want to locate at Bramblebush is already medical uses are allowable. So, it would be a place where they could locate.
So this is part of the opioid epidemic approach here to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting in this article that how the chief of police of Falmouth went out to look at the methadone clinic in Yarmouth.
Yeah, he did. The one in Plymouth.
This particular company
operates, I believe, 29 methadone clinics throughout the country. There is one in Plymouth, and Falmouth Police Chief Dunn went on a tour of the clinic in January. He described it as professional, looking like a regular doctor's office, and very well run. Most patients arrive there between 5 and 10 a.m. They drink a liquid serving of methadone and go off to work or school. So the fears of this being, for lack of a better phrase, a hangout,
right.
He said that really wouldn't be an issue. And one of the reasons there is a need for this type of clinic is in Falmouth, according to the chief, is Falmouth has so many treatment and recovery centers. A lot of people come here for those services and they stay. So there is quite a number of people that could take advantage of this clinic.
And I guess there's a concern that the treatment, especially for something like fentanyl, which is so powerful, mm-hmm. that if people go into treatment for a 7-day treatment, they're nowhere near done.
It's just not enough. Yeah. And we've talked about this, and a lot of experts have talked about this over in recent years, that there is a need for extended rehabilitation services.
Mm. Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times with us here. Jeff, we had a couple of dog attacks in the news last fall into the winter. A forum in Sandwich this week addressed some of the ways to deal with dangerous dogs.
Yeah, it did. And this was a forum that was coordinated and arranged by State Representative Randy Hunt, who's from Sandwich and represents the town. There have been several attacks in recent months by pit bulls specifically, including one that just gave life-threatening injuries to a baby in Falmouth. And there was one pit bull in Sandwich named Bubba, attacked a woman in October. Mm-hmm. She had to spend some time in the hospital, still undergoing treatment for her injuries. And this same dog named Bubba, he was returned to his owners after a dangerousness hearing in the town of Sandwich. And he was returned just as long as he could be muzzled outside of his house. Wasn't enough. In December, he went for a grooming at PetSmart in Hyannis, attacked the groomer, who had to be med-flighted to Boston for treatment, and he was euthanized the next day. So people want to know, what can we do to prevent this from happening again? And there were a lot of ideas talked about at this forum. Do we have stricter leash laws? Do we give discounts on dog licenses for owners who take their dogs for training? A lot of ideas thrown around, including stiffer punishment for people who don't take these precautions with their dogs. And it's interesting here in Massachusetts that while these attacks, these really devastating attacks, have all been by pit bulls, there cannot be anything done on the state or local level that regulations created that are based on breeds.
I didn't know that until I read this story.
You can't have breed-specific rules. And reason I know that, I'm on the Mashpee Dog Park Committee for several years, and we had learned that. You can't for lack of a better term, discriminate against pit bulls.
Against a certain, any particular breed.
Any breed, but they tend to come to mind when you think about regulations. So at the end of the forum, Representative Hunt advised people, hey, you know, if you want to get a petition regarding changes in dangerous dog policies, you have until March 1st to submit an article for the Sandwich Town meeting, which is coming up in May. So we'll see as to what happens there and what some of the suggestions may be at town meeting.
And some folks at that forum were talking about the that there's no real discernment between the severity of an attack.
Yeah, you know, between a bite and a mauling.
Right. And then that under the law, an attack is an attack.
Exactly.
Another story this week, a kind of a strange and troubling story about an aide to State Representative Randy Hunt and an incident in Boston.
Yes, exactly. Matthew Lieber, who is the legislative aide to Representative Hunt, he works out of the office on Beacon Hill. He's a very lucky young man, Steve. Last weekend, on Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, about 1:45, he was randomly attacked in the Allston section of Boston after leaving a club. He was walking along the street, which is, for those familiar with Allston, it's very popular amongst young people, especially college students, so not uncommon to see a lot of people walking there at that hour or going home. He was trying to get an Uber ride, and I called Representative Hunt to get a little more information. He said he was attacked out of the blue. He was walking down the street. Someone yelled at him, and within seconds, he was being stabbed on his right side, which can be very dangerous. I mean, a matter of an inch when you get stabbed like that could mean recovery or something far worse. He was rushed to Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital due to the injuries. I'm guessing he was released by now. He's supposed to fully recover. But as if he wasn't lucky enough, we go a little further with the luck. At the time, a state police cruiser...
If you can call it luck, wrapped into a story in which somebody gets randomly stabbed. But
exactly. And I should mention that he's 25 years old. A state police cruiser happened to be driving by while this was happening. And, of course, they rushed to the... When they saw this altercation happening, the attacker, a 39-year-old man from Brookline, was arrested right then and there, and they did find the knife that was used in the attack. And we'll be interested to find out what happens with that man and what led him to go after Mr. Lieber.
Strange story, but it's good to hear that he's expected to recover.
Exactly. I've worked with him quite a bit, and when I'm trying to work with Representative Hunt's office, very friendly, very helpful.
That's great, yes. This is The Point, the news roundup on The Point. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to go to the break now. After we come back from the break, we're going to hear from Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. There's more in a moment. This is the news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And Jeff, the latest inspection at Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station has found no violations. And to anyone who's been following this, that's actually news.
It really is, Steve. I can't remember in the course of the past 3 years not being here and speaking about some news regarding Pilgrim and an inspection and it not being good news.
Yeah.
But for the inspection done on the plant by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for the fourth quarter in 2017 found no violations. During this inspection, they looked at the readiness for the plant for extreme weather conditions, flood and fire protections, equipment and procedures, maintenance effectiveness, and emergency preparedness. A far cry from the other inspections that were held, the three inspections in 2017.
Each of those other inspections had yielded a number of violations.
They did.
Within 2017, yeah.
Yeah, collectively there were 15 violations during 2017. And one of them was an incorrectly installed valve that caused 55,000 gallons of water to rush into the base of the nuclear reactor. You know, quite an oops right there. And, of course, and we've talked about this quite a bit, the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is set to close Yeah, just a little bit over a year now, May 31st, 2019.
One of the other things this report pointed out is that the power station has been addressing problems that it has with the spent fuel rod pools and these shields, these protective panels that have, they were identified as deteriorating dangerously.
Yeah, very, very important because these could remain there for decades after the plant closes. So something that, that needs to be watched very closely.
And the plant, again, is slated to permanently shut down by May 31st, 2019.
That's right.
We are going to go now to Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner, who joins us on the phone. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, and with us here is Jeff Spillane.
Hi, Casey.
Hi, Jeff. Miss you.
I miss you, too.
So, Casey, for folks just tuning into this program, Casey used to be with the Cape Cod Times long, long time. She's now editor at the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us. I want to ask you, last week we heard about the town of Wellfleet's plan to keep the parking lot at Cahoon Hollow closed for this coming summer instead of trying to repair it. This week it's another Wellfleet Beach parking lot that's the center of contention. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, this is Whitecrest Beach, which after Cahoon has been declared closed for the season, this will be the only beach where people from out of town can pay $20 to stay for the day, to go to the beaches during the day. So it's also the only beach with the real potential to expand parking spaces, and that's what the town is talking about. They're wanting to expand that parking lot from 225 spaces to 460 spaces. And the town administrator is going to ask at town meeting, that's the plan so far anyway, he's going to ask at town meeting whether or not the voters want to do this. And there's great public need for it because we're losing so many parking spaces to erosion. But there's also a lot of opposition, and they're really getting busy with online, mostly online discussions when they're talking about maybe hiring a lawyer and maybe starting a citizen's petition to come to town meeting.
What are some what are some of the concerns of the folks who are in opposition to this?
Well, they fear that Ocean View Drive is already a very busy road during the summer. It's really the place to be if you're coming, if you're visiting Wellfleet as a tourist. You really want to go to the beaches. So it's already a crowded road, and with the additional spaces, those in opposition say it'll even be more crowded and more dangerous. And it's also, I mean, the beaches aren't crowded in the sense of maybe Long Island, but the beaches will be more crowded too. That's another complaint.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where does this look like it goes next?
So it's going to go to town meeting, and we'll see what the vote is if the town approves the expansion. It was going to be 600, up to 600 cars. Now it's down to 460, maybe in an attempt to compromise. But we'll see. If it passes town meeting, then the expansion is supposed to start in the fall.
Casey, you've also got a story about the lunch program in the Provincetown schools, and I think this provides an important insight into the school district and the community it serves.
Yeah, it really is interesting. So for the second year in a row, the Provincetown schools are offering, able to serve lunch and breakfast free to all their students through the community eligibility provision of the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. And that's a program where if you meet the qualifications, you get these free meals. The qualifications are very different than what most people think of as Provincetown, which is an extremely wealthy community in the sense that it costs about $700,000 to buy a single family home here. But when you look at the year-round residents, particularly those with kids, it's really a different story. There's there's a 58.3% rate of high needs students, which is anything from they could be foster children or be homeless or meet eligibilities, income eligibilities through Head Start and a few other things. So it's just a very high needs population, and that's obviously not good. But the good part of it is that they can offer these amazing lunches And the man who heads the lunch program is really creative, and he's been able to serve things like chicken satay with sunflower butter sauce and coconut rice, Mongolian beef and broccoli, Honduran baladas, Jamaican beef patties, and, you know, so he can get really creative, and that's wonderful because the school's also really diverse. They have 20% of the students there are African-American and 17% Hispanic.
And again, just to underscore this point, because the district has such a high percentage of children who qualify for this, they can give these lunches free to all the students. They essentially just give them to all the students, and so there's no stigma attached with this program either then.
Yeah.
That's right. That's a big yes, exactly. Yeah. Not an issue anymore. You don't have to be identified that way during lunch or breakfast.
Yeah, that's right. And the same type of program is in place at the Hyannis West Elementary School as well, where I believe it was about 85% of the children did qualify, and they just decided, hey, let's just go to 100%.
Yeah. Great story there. Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Nice to talk to both of you.
Okay. Same here.
With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And Jeff, a bid to expand a Hyannis business zone has come to an abrupt finish. We've talked about this a number of times on the Roundup, and I'm glad that you're here for this because you've covered this, and it's a bit complicated.
I have. It is complicated, and it's become a very contentious issue in the Cape's largest town during the past month. And the issue here, Steve, is whether to include a 55-acre parcel on Scudder Avenue in Hyannis. A lot of people could be familiar with this because it's a lot across from the Cape Cod Melody Tent, has the hotel and a golf course called Twin Brooks Golf Course. To add this into what's called the Hyannis Growth Incentive Zone, which is a designation that is provided by the Cape Cod Commission, what it does, if you're in the Growth Incentive Zone, in order to promote economic development, investment opportunities, and revitalize areas that really need it, it waives the development of regional impact requirement by the Cape Cod Commission, which can be very time-consuming, very expensive. But a lot of people are not aware that town and environmental regulations would still apply. And this was a 10-year designation. It's expiring on April 4th, so the town of Barnstable needs to file an application to renew the growth incentive zone, and that's why the expanding the borders is a big issue. Now they need to know what they want to apply for. The Oceanside Performing Arts Center,
which is the other big piece,
that's the other big piece, has a purchase and sale agreement for the 40 acres in which the golf course is located right now, and from what I can tell and what they're telling us, this Oceanside Performing Arts Center, they want to design as if it's a mini Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of opposition to some of the neighbors with the parking, et cetera. So they were out in force trying to stop this expansion of the business zone. So right before the town council was going to take this up last week, a lawyer for the Finch Group, which is a Boca Raton, Florida organization that owns the property, said, you know what, we're going to withdraw our request to have this property put in.
To be included in the growth
incentive zone. Yeah, they said it's just too much of a distraction in town, and it's, you know, it's a distraction to the Oceanside Performing Arts Center as well. So they have withdrawn that, which now we go back to the original growth incentive zone boundaries, which it expects to, we expect will be approved next Thursday night.
But in the article, you point out that this might not be the end of things.
It may not be the end of it. The Cape Cod Commission, meanwhile, it's kind of at the same time, is taking a look at what the requirements are for a growth incentive zone, especially some of the environmental requirements. They may change this over the course of the next few weeks. And some of the opponents are saying, yeah, we expect that this will be back in front of the authorities at some point, officials very soon, to have this put back in.
And, yeah.
I also spoke with Gerald Gernick. He's an attorney in Hyannis. He's also the president of the Oceanside Performing Arts Center Board of Trustees. Not phased by this at all. Says the plans are still moving forward. This Performing Arts Center is going to be a key to revitalizing downtown Hyannis. And during this process, they're going to work with neighbors and businesses to hear their concerns and work with them.
So that story it sounded like that when they decided to pull out of that growth incentive zone, that it was quite a surprise to a lot of people.
It was quite a surprise. And in order for that to move forward, the expansion of the zone, it would have had to have passed the town planning board and the town council by a majority vote. So you would have needed 4 in the planning board, 7 from the town council. And they may have done some math there as well and said, yeah, this may not fly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's look at another story now. It looks like a number of smaller farms in Truro and Wellfleet will band together to get into the marijuana growing business. This is an opportunity that some folks were really pushing for as the rules were being discussed.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've all heard about and familiar with craft beers. And, you know, how about craft marijuana? That looks as if this is something that's going to be happening here in the state. There are 5 farms in Truro and 1 in Wellfleet who have announced that they are going to band together as a group to cultivate a craft crop of marijuana. And this is a huge opportunity for the economy in the Outer Cape, says this gentleman named David DeWitt, the chair of Truro's Agricultural Commission, who provide year-round jobs and really help some farms that have been struggling over the past few years. They will join together as a cooperative to cultivate, manufacture, process, package, and brand their craft marijuana, which in turn will be delivered to shops. But they can't not sell it directly to consumers. So they do need to apply for a license, which I may add, this whole concept of craft marijuana and operating cooperatives was added to the state's marijuana legislation last year by no other than Sarah Peake, state representative from Provincetown, and Julian Sear, the state senator from Truro. So folks right in those two districts seem to be taking advantage of this right off the bat.
Well, they were saying that they see this as helping areas in the far-flung corners of the Commonwealth, is what Sear said, like the Cape and Islands and like the Berkshires.
And the Berkshires, yeah. Right. Where there are a lot of farms in rural areas, and this can really help keep some of these farms afloat. And also, they say that it's going to decrease the influence of the existing black market for certain types of special marijuana. And this is going to be discussed next week in Truro, and then we'll be on to the state and federal.
Well, you can understand why farmers would see this as an opportunity really to grow a cash crop or a crop that has potential to really bring in a good amount of money.
That's right. You know, this cooperates with cranberry growers. So why not with this crop?
Sort of keeping in the same vein here in Chatham this week, we saw another example of a town wrestling with the approach to recreational marijuana. The Chatham board talking about what they were going to do with this.
Yeah, the folks in Chatham voted against recreational marijuana by 57% for 43 back in November 16. But the planning board there in town, I guess it was a little bit of a surprise last week, did not endorse a proposed bylaw that would prohibit commercial recreational marijuana being sold in the town. Still is probably going to be a question at town meeting in May for a ban, but this was quite a bit of a surprise. The selectman named Dean Nicastro, who is really for a ban in Chatham, says if we were to have recreational marijuana in this quintessential Cape town, it would take away from the family-friendly image of Chatham, and it would introduce tawdriness and unseemliness. Planning board, in their deliberation, said, you know, this is an overstep to ban recreational marijuana. It's not a very powerful drug, and it's legal. Whereas another member of the board said it's an overreaction. The drug that's really causing harm here in Chatham is alcohol. And they also cited the economic boon it could bring to town. And one of the selectmen also said, you know, the bylaws are too broad. You know, perhaps we don't allow recreational sales here, but why not labs or cultivation, perhaps on the outskirts of town? This is happening all through all our 15 towns, it seems, Steve.
Yep, we're wrestling with how this is going to roll out.
That's right.
This is the News Roundup. Excuse me, I'm Steve Junker with us from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff Spillane, we're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Barry Stringfellow with the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. I'm going to speak now with Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Steve.
Barry, there's an interesting story you've got of a tangled web of criminal activity and some good police work. Tell us about this.
Well, it involves two investigations of two separate crimes in two different towns, some good police work, and unfortunately an overdose death that led to several arrests, including one man that was implicated in both crimes. It began with Oak Bluffs police investigating a break-in by a resident who said he had had a large amount of cash, a laptop computer, and cell phone stolen. And the police saw that it was a targeted robbery, and a person of interest became Jason Reagan, who has a long criminal record and who had done work at the house 6 months prior.
A large amount of cash. You're talking about more than $50,000.
Well, initially, the police thought it was $20,000, and then after surveilling his house, they saw him go down to the lagoon, and he lived near the lagoon, a wooded path, and return. They didn't find anything, but this ties into a few days later when there was a call for a domestic disturbance at his house, and he told police his girlfriend had stolen $50,000 from him. His girlfriend is independently involved with appealing the Oak Bluff selectman ruling that to euthanize her pit bull, which has been a problem in the neighborhood and almost fatally mauled a dog in November. She's been appealing that, and it's going to go to a de novo trial in March. Turned out some of his money went to paying the legal fees for that. So they find it's, you know, more than $20,000. It's over $50,000. They determined that some of this money had gone to a person who independently bought drugs with that money, and he was arrested in connection with, unfortunately, a fatal overdose. And while police in Oak Bluffs were writing him up for receiving stolen goods, they got a call from Tisbury saying that they had arrested this man, Jason Willoughby, who also has an extensive criminal record for possession of and distribution of fentanyl. One of the interesting things that was taking place with the Oak Bluffs investigation is they asked Reagan about where he got the $50,000. He said he found it and he couldn't remember where, but police went back to the location where, to the lagoon, and because of an astronomically low tide, they did find some of the stolen goods, a computer and cell phones, farther out in the lagoon, and they probably wouldn't have found it without that astronomical low tide, and also it was daylight. So that nailed Jason Reagan to the robbery, and he told police that he had given money to Jason Willoughby to buy the drugs, and Willoughby told his uncle that it was heroin. His uncle thought, and he's also got a long record, his uncle thought it didn't seem like heroin, and unfortunately it was not, and his uncle's girlfriend was the overdose victim. Mm. So both men are in Dukes County Jail, and trial or arraignment's coming up in March.
Barry, I want to turn to a different story that you guys have this week. It may seem like a funny time of year to be talking about this, about fishing, but in fact, this isn't just a thin excuse to get to the topic. There's a good reason to talk about fishing in mid-February. Tell us about this story.
Absolutely. It gives hope for summer. The state Fishing Derby handed out awards at the boat show last week. And out of 31 possible winning trophies, the Vineyarders brought home 8. And they made a clean sweep of the False Albacore trophies, and the David Nash of Edgartown won it on a fly, which is pretty amazing. One of them, Tony Jackson, won with the Bonito division, and it was a fish that would have won the Martha's Vineyard Derby, but he caught it in November. And the juniors also did well, and Mason Warburton of West Tisbury, with his Martha's Vineyard Derby winning fish, won the state crown with an 18-pound bluefish, which is a massive bluefish. So we didn't have an Island Cup this year, but we're keeping score. The Vineyard beat Nantucket 8-2.
I want to back up just a moment, though. This prize-winning Bonito was caught in November.
Yeah. Apparently, the Bonitos stick around longer than False Albacore, and because of the warm fall, that was a surprise to me too. But the fellow that caught it, Tony Jackson, he fishes year round, and he said there's no fishing season for him. And he said, "I always have hope." So,
all right, Barry Stringfellow from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Barry, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane, and Jeff. A long dormant historical building in Hyannis may see a renovation. This is a pretty interesting old building.
It is, and it may have a new life soon. This is the former National Guard Armory in Hyannis. It's right across from Town Hall near the harbor, and it's where President-elect John F. Kennedy gave his victory speech in 1960, so a very historic building. In 2006, the state conveyed the building and the property to the town of Barnstable. It's been largely vacant since, and as you can probably imagine, falling into a state of disrepair. So Senator Julian Sear had managed to get $1.6 million in state capital in the state capital bond bill last week for improvements to the facility. The Senate version of the capital bond bill now goes to the House for some reconciliation, and then it would go on to Governor Baker for approval. And it should also be noted that if it is approved, it gets a governor's signature, the governor has up to 5 years to release those funds, but they're hoping that would happen a lot sooner regarding this particular property. And also, you know,
so the town owns this building, and Or it manages
does.
This building?
No, it owns it. It owns it, but when it was turned over to the town from the state, there were some restrictions, some really strict restrictions put upon this. It cannot be sold, cannot be demolished. At least it's a very historic building, and it can only be used for municipal purposes, and later they said it could be used for a museum, including a nonprofit museum. And realizing that this money, this windfall may come from the state, last week, the Barnstable town manager, Mark Hells, put in an appropriation request for about $200,000 to get the ball rolling here to start design and permitting processes. That should be approved this coming Thursday by the Barnstable Town Council. He says once that's approved, they're going to start almost immediately with some of the design work here. Another interesting restriction that's placed on this property is the historic wall-mounted plaques cannot be disturbed without first contacting the Massachusetts Military Division. As you can imagine, being a former National Guard Armory, there's quite a bit of those in there. So,
you reported this story. Did you go into the building?
I have not been in there.
Okay.
I would like to.
Yeah.
And hopefully at some point we can get in there. And also, just to add here, since it's been under the town's control since 2006. There have been some RFPs put out there for use of the armory. 4 responses have come through in those years, including one for a pirate museum, which I'm guessing I know where that went. But the cost of making the building usable was just, it was prohibitive, and it was a deterrent for anyone signing a lease there. So once they get this building back up to snuff, I'm sure that it will find a new life rather quickly.
We're going to speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, one of the strange and troubling consequences of the shooting at a Florida high school last week is that it seems to have triggered copycat threats at other schools across the country, including on the South Coast. Tell us about this.
Yes, that's right. We've actually seen two things happen, and that's the first. So in the days that were immediately following the school shooting, there were a number of threats made, either in messages that were overheard by students, overheard another student talking, or messages that were posted on social media. So in one of the instances, a teenage student made a verbal threat about shooting up the school in Westport. Now, that student was charged with a serious charge of making terrorist threats, and that's a felony in Massachusetts. So we had that. We had in Fall River two separate posts on Snapchat, one of them warning of a Florida Part Two at Durfee High School in Fall River. And there was also another threat in Dartmouth that was posted on Snapchat. In New Bedford, there was a student who made a verbal threat to shoot up a New Bedford school, and that one's under investigation, but administrators and police deemed that threat was not a viable, credible threat. So in a lot of these cases here and across the state, suspects are charged, but they're juvenile, so we don't get a lot of information on them. The police investigated, and the schools naturally had to take the threats, you know, pretty seriously. In our instances, there were school resources officers that were assigned. In some cases, parents were notified. And as I mentioned, there were criminal charges filed.
Andy, so, yes. What kind of security measures then are the schools taking when they get these kinds of threats?
Well, that's the second part of what we're seeing. And this week, this is school vacation week now that's ending. So schools were out, and that's part, the threats have been sort of quieted down. But this week, a lot of public officials are asking those questions. And last night, New Bedford City Councilor Brian Gomes filed two written motions for the City Council that are aimed at two things. One, finding out exactly what security is there, and then strengthening security in the city schools, or at least finding out how much it will cost. So we asked the mayor and the superintendent to research the cost of these safety measures, including installing panic buttons, having surveillance cameras installed, developing, you know, elaborate evacuation plans, detailed plans, hiring armed guards possibly, and installing a hotline for students to report possible threatening activity. So Gomes also asked the mayor to meet over training in this active threat resolution for officers, and to provide information on the buildings where employees have received ALICE training, and that's alert, lockdown, inform, counter, and evacuation. And there's actually a training program that's available for people to look at these things. So yeah, it's frightening that we have to come to this. You know, there are already many measures at some of our schools, not every school. In New Bedford, the guests are often, they have to buzz at the entrances, and they first come into a vestibule, like a trap room, before they're gained admittance to the school. And some of this happened after Columbine and Sandy Hook. And in Fall River, you know, they have extra measures where school administrators sent a note to parents this week so that when the kids come back to school on Monday, they're going to find there are extra security measures in place. Not in the form of equipment, but there'll be different, you know, restrictions on the doors that are open, and then guards at the entranceways.
Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Jeff Spillane is with us from the Cape Cod Times. And Jeff, a fatal overdose has now led to a manslaughter indictment. Though it may sound straightforward, this is actually kind of unusual.
It is unusual, Steve. This happened last week. A Barnstable County grand jury has charged a 25-year-old South Dennis man with manslaughter in relation to the fatal overdose last March. It was fentanyl was involved of a friend of his. It's uncommon because it's very hard to prove who supplied a fatal dose, according to the district attorney here on the Cape and Islands. The man who this gentleman was with, he called 911 for him, and he said, you know, I tried to call the dealer and talking with him, and here's the number. But an investigation proved that the records didn't match. So it proved that he was the dealer himself. And this goes back to last August, this interesting Governor Baker had filed a bill that said dealers could be subject to manslaughter charges. You know, it could go up to life in prison with a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years. And we don't see this often. And District Attorney O'Keefe here on the Cape said he supports the governor's bill, but he says to families of overdose victims, don't get your hopes up that in every case somebody will be charged, because it's just so difficult to prove. Toxicology reports often show that there are several substances in a person's body. So you really can't determine where they came from. And but it would, according to O'Keefe, if there was this possible charge of life in prison hanging over the heads of dealers, would act as a deterrent.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, your beat includes the Barnstable County Commissioners. You have a story this week about one of the commissioners refusing to sign codes of conduct documents.
Yeah, I do cover the county and the commissioners. A lot of drama here. It's like a reality show sometimes, Steve. But on Wednesday, Commissioner Ron Beatty, a lot of people know him. He's pretty controversial and has been for years. He refused to sign the county's sexual harassment, social media, and vehicle use policies. Ironically, Beatty has approved these in past meetings, and in fact, he made the motion to implement them back in December. And with the sexual harassment policies, to be specific about that, it's state law that those must be distributed to people every year, and they must acknowledge them by signing them and getting them back to Human Resources. Reason being, if something were to happen and somebody said, hey, well, I didn't know that we couldn't do that, you got to say, well, here, you had it and you saw it. And Beatty himself is known for having quite a presence on Twitter, dozens of controversial posts each day, and also had got some heat recently for criticizing the Me Too movement. He said that he didn't know that he was going to be asked to sign these documents. And as a result, he didn't want to be part of an open meeting law violation, and that if he did so, he would have signed them under duress. So Leo Kukunis, who is the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners, was quite upset.
And he expressed himself quite
he
strongly.
He did. It was pretty colorful, and said, listen, next week, if he doesn't sign them, I'm going to personally hand them to him during the meeting with the video cameras rolling. If he refuses to take them, then he will go next door to the court and have an officer serve the documents to him.
More excitement at the county commissioner.
That's right.
I want to touch on a story that earlier this week, a piece of bone was extracted from some material recovered from a pirate shipwreck off the Cape. There was a fair amount of media coverage about this.
A lot of media attention, Steve. This happened on Monday and just happens to be the Monday of the week that the Whydah Pirate Museum is opened for school vacation. A piece of human bone was pulled out from a massive sediment there at the museum by an archaeologist, and they're hoping that when they have this bone, they did pull it out, there'll be enough DNA present, even though the Whydah went down 300 years ago, to determine if the bone indeed belongs to the famous or infamous pirate Samuel Black Sam Bellamy. And this is being conducted by scientists from the University of New Haven. If they do have enough DNA, they're going to test the DNA and see if it matches with one of Bellamy's descendants in Britain. They have touched base with him or her, and they're willing to do it. But we won't know for a while. The DNA extraction could take as long as a month, and then the test could be about 6 weeks. So it'll be a while. If it does turn out that this is the bone of Black Sam Bellamy, it's going to be sent back to England for burial.
Mm-hmm. That is the news roundup here for the week. I want to thank my guests from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
You're welcome.
And we heard from Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, heard from Barry Stringfellow at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis at southcoasttoday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Steve Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.